All right, so we're sitting down with Tom Sachs. Tom, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with me.
Thanks for having me, Hadi.
Yeah, well, let's get right to it. A lot of people are going to come and see this exhibition. The Nasher is like sort of the place to hang out, you know. But I don't think very many people will know what bricolage is or maybe understand your practice. So I wonder if I could start by just sort of having you describe what it is that you make.
Well, bricolage is the act of making or repairing something with available limited resources. So you might not know the word, but you definitely know the action because you've done it yourself or you've seen it. Duct tape is kind of the ultimate bricolage material. I employ this practice in making sculpture. It's the foundation of what I do. I'm self-taught, so I am really good at welding and carpentry, but I have a lot of bad habits that I've been extending for 30 years into my sculpture. So a lot of the materials are found, or else if they were once found, now that I've been doing it for a while, I kind of use the same ones over and over again. I'm really interested in materials that are everyday, that are normal, that are not exotic, and then the objects that I make are everyday objects, like a mop bucket or a skateboard ramp, or in this case, a tea ceremony.
One of the things I've kind of found out looking into you, especially because I'm seeing that you're building these buildings and these places, you know, that you're going to spend time in theoretically for the tea ceremony. And I was wondering, how does he know how to do that? And I found out that you spent some time studying architecture and as well as having an interest in furniture design and furniture building. And I guess I'm kind of curious how those things kind of factor into it. Because when I look now, I'm like, oh man, like I could totally see how someone could use stop signs or, you know, construction materials to create that. But at first, it just doesn't click in the brain, you know?
Well, 30 years ago when I was in college, I was studying architecture and sculpture. I didn't think that I was talented enough to make it as a sculptor. So I went to architecture school, and architecture school is kind of like the Navy SEALs. They do everything they can to make you quit. And I was one of those guys that rang the bell and dropped out, probably because I saw that it was just about as hard to make it as an architect as it was to make it as a sculptor. The world doesn't love architecture. It likes engineering and per square foot valuation of occupancy space. And the architects that make it, someone like Frank Gehry, are really sculptors. They're just medium as architecture. But so at some point, I when I was in my early 20s, I was living in England. I was really taken by how dystopic the place felt already even then. It was poor, the affluence was extreme and small pockets, and it really just felt like we were going to hell in a handbasket. 30 years later, all those problems are the same. There's more affluence there, but there's also more poverty everywhere in the world. It's just the world's become more and more at risk as our natural environment and natural resources are being exploited and wrecked. But I think there was a moment when I saw the kind of demise of Western civilization. I thought, instead of making really nice banks, ATMs, and hospitals, I'm just going to make good sculpture and enjoy the ride.
Well, you know, the things you're making, you know, a Japanese tea room, you know, a form of a NASA launching site, you know, those things cost a lot of money, but you're making them with everyday goods, as you said, you know, found material. Do you feel as though this has kind of allowed you to still flex those architectural muscles?
I think so. It's in my blood. I like building things, and I'm obsessed with how we interact with the materials around our lives, the clothes, the cars, the buildings, the food we put into our bodies, the way we organize natural resources. So I love the tea ceremony because it represents all of the things that man can do. It's got spirituality with Zen. It's got architecture with the tea house and with all the tea bowls and the scoops. And it's got poetry and painting with the scrolls. And it's even got performance and dance and movement with the way the hand gestures work when pouring tea. So it's really got all the four classical parts of art in it, and it's a perfect armature or foundation for me to explore all these things. So, and yes, so architecture is a priority because it's how materials go together to support our actions.
Well, I want to talk more about the tea ceremony, but before I do, I just wanted to make sure I ask some of these questions about your making, you know. I watched the short film 10 Bullets, which is basically a new hire video of how to work in your studio. Can you talk about that studio space? You know, I'm curious, what does it look like? How do things work in there? And why did you choose? I read that you worked in like the back of a bodega once. So I'm kind of curious as to what that whole vibe is. I feel like I'm lucky. Our listeners aren't. I get to meet you. So I feel like I'm sort of getting the vibe. But if you could help us out.
Absolutely. So first of all, www.10bullets.com. Go there. You can watch all of our movies for free. And I would start with 10 Bullets. And if you like that, watch A Love Letter to Plywood. And the Love Letter to Plywood shows our building code, how we make things in plywood. Because it's not the right way or the wrong way, but my way. And that's important because that way, by following my way of making things, you have the quality and idiosyncrasies and consistency of the way we make things. But 10 bullets are the code by which we live and die. Kind of like the 10 commandments or the 11 satanic rules of the earth. All good guidelines to aspire to, impossible to adhere to perfectly. It's just like a compass to put you in the right direction. The studio is a cult. There are 12 of us. We worship plywood as our main goddess, and we violate her daily with the table saw, and we have the most respect for the materials around us as we abuse them and beat them into the form that our will dictates.
I think I've asked you a little bit as to why you make sculpture, but I'm curious why you make art.
Well, the secret to success in any field is doing what you love and getting so good at it that people pay you to do it. Because if you consider the alternative is being really well paid or badly paid for doing something that you don't love, that's like a living hell, because then you're just working for money. And I'm very privileged and lucky that things lined up for me, but it was a couple of dozen years of working on what I loved for no pay, the total dedication before I was able to organize my life enough that I could make a living making sculpture. But in that time, I made my living making things for other people. And always pushing the limits of making that experience of working for other people as rewarding for me by doing the best work that I could for others. You know, my big breakthrough was when I was a janitor and I had to clean this room, and I was working with a team of other people cleaning the room, and I decided I was going to be the best at cleaning this room. One of the other guys, the most senior guy in the group, said, "Hey man, you're making us all look bad." And I said, "Go fuck yourself. I'm going to do the best job I can here so that this room gets cleaned faster and better, and we do a good job for the people who need this room clean." And he was really mad because he was just viewing, you know, he didn't love the job, but he was senior. And after years of doing that and doing other odd jobs, I was able to slowly make a higher percentage of my hours of my day into making my sculpture. But I guess the secret is taking the same attitude towards both, that the only thing that you own is your time and your thought. Even if you're working for someone else by the hour, how you think about it is the one thing that you control.
Let's go back to 2012 a little bit. Space program, Mars, I believe maybe your biggest installation to date. During the time, you'd done an interview with WNYC in New York, and you said that you create art in order to learn about the world and to entertain yourself.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how tackling something as both abstract and like in your face as a space program, sure, fits into that?
So that quote was said to me by the great, late great Glenn O'Brien, and I've taken it as a mantra for my entire practice, my way of living. I was a terrible student. I did ninth grade twice. I had to do summer school. I had tutors, child psychiatrists. I was involved. I got in trouble with the police. I was really a mess and was bad at sports. Like everything that could go wrong kind of went wrong mentally. And at some point when I found sculpture, I found a way to work. And in that time, the world opened up to me because I was finally passionate about something. And then I became like successful in school. And it was, like I said, a couple of dozen years before I was able to like parlay that into a career with this. But the feeling of satisfaction, success was immediate, even if my job was cleaning toilets. And over the years, I've looked to different things, whether it was the space program or the tea ceremony, or before that, modernism and architecture, and even before that, modern sculpture, like the things we have here at the Nash, or like Giacometti or Brancusi. But the greatest privilege of my career as an artist is to spend time educating myself. I was a bad student, so I have a lot of resentment about education built in. After a dozen years of bad training, I finally found a way to love learning. And when I built my own space program, I was able to learn all about rocket engineering, astronomy, physics, and most importantly about biology and genetics, because the reason we go to other planets is to start understanding some philosophical things about where did we come from? Are we alone? What is the origin of life? And so the NASA space program is an investigation into our DNA and who we are and where we come from. It becomes very philosophical, really. It answers the questions that religion have been trying to answer for millennia. Are we alone? Where did we come from? And we're getting close. We're using science to, we got to the moon in the 60s. We killed God. We proved he doesn't exist. And now we're starting to like dig those questions up again. Well, if he doesn't exist, what's out there? Where did life come from? And we're starting to get close to potentially finding another sample of life in the universe as we know it. Dr. Kevin Han from Jet Propulsion Laboratory said, if he doesn't, and he's an astrobiologist, he says, if I don't find life off of planet Earth in the next 30 years, I'm going back to organized religion. and that's something that I'm interested in. So whether it's the space program or the tea ceremony, which is a 500-year-old tradition, if you look at it, could be much older if you go back to its roots. It's a place where all of the arts come together with architecture and poetry and hospitality and sort of religion almost, or at least philosophy with Zen.
Well, you know, a few years back, I got to have a talk with astronaut Chris Hadfield, you know, the guy who's made famous from the video he did of the David Bowie song.
Yeah.
And he talked a little bit about the rituals needed to do his work. A lot of repetition, a lot of understanding why you're doing that repetition, a lot of, hey, this needs to be done in this order, or we're not going to get into the sky, or we're not going to be able to land successfully, things like that, you know. And you brought up the 500-year tradition of the tea ceremony. Before we go down that road, can I ask you, what is maybe your fascination with ritual? Because it seems as though the two things that I know you of, and then you also had this boombox exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum. I mean, all of those things deal with ritual. I mean, the boombox museum alone, I think you had 18 boomboxes all playing music at the exact same time. I mean, that's an homage to the music that was being pumped out of there. That's very ritualistic in itself.
Ritual is everything. Without ritual, the sculptures in this show and the things that I make don't have any value. I had this revelation when I was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and I saw all this stuff that was made for dead rich guys, like paintings and sculptures made for popes, or things made for pharaohs, or things made for hedge fund guys, like paintings and sculptures, whatever, by people like me, makers. And then I went to the African department, I saw things that were made by makers for people in their community. And those things tended to have more of a utilitarian nature, or they were used in a ritual like a mask or some other object of devotion. And they were used in activities and things. And those sculptures really excited me. And I thought, I want to make art that works like that in my life. That's the strategy I want. I don't want to make some thing that hangs on the wall. If some rich guy buys the thing that I made and hangs it on his wall, that's his problem. That's fine. But while the thing's alive, I want it to work. And that's why I always say that museums are where art goes to die. It's alive in your hands or on the street. And that's why for us, the tea ceremony is real. Our space program is real. We go to Mars at the Park Avenue Armory, or we go to Europa at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And when we take rock samples out of the ground and have them analyzed, those are real rock samples. And the first time we did that was in 2007 at Gagosian Gallery in Beverly Hills. We jackhammered up the floor. We brought those rocks to Brooklyn College. We had a petrographic analysis made of them, and it's publishable, and you can download that report for free at tomsachs.com. And Brooklyn College found that, in fact, our moon rocks were concrete, and they had evidence of floor wax on them. By taking this kind of, might sound like deadpan humor, but by taking it to that extreme degree, the experience for us becomes authentic. So, and that's where my focus is in the making. But it doesn't mean anything without the sensuality, without the spirituality, without the concepts behind it.
Well, they're telling us we don't have very much time, so I'm going to kind of run through these quickly. So, you know, Tea Ceremony debuted at the Noguchi Museum last year. What was it like to be the first artist to exhibit in that space after such a long period?
Well, it was a great honor to exhibit along with Osamu Noguchi in his museum that was once his studio. Noguchi was a student of Brancusi, and Brancusi was a student of Rodin. I would like in some way to although I didn't ever meet Noguchi, to imagine some of the work that I'm doing formally being in the tradition of some of the things that he investigated. His basalt sculptures are still they're the 2001 monolith for me.
Well, you know, Chanoyo is a form of art and a form of ritual. And as we've discussed, the tea itself, the matcha, it's not the fanciest of teas. You know, it's, I think you said it was dirt. I think what I've heard it as is kind of almost like ground up leftovers. I'm curious, what made you interested in that? I mean, matcha is so popular in food now, you know, but you're not even dealing with that. You're dealing with it in its truest form.
Well, we get the good shit from Kyoto. It's the expensive, best matcha you can get, arguably. And it does taste a little like dirt. It is very refined. And there's a movie that we'll be posting online on our YouTube channel or on 10bullets.com. You can go to Tom Sachs' YouTube is probably the best place, and you'll see how matcha is made. There's a good video that's coming. That'll be out when this is out. I don't particularly care for the taste of it. It does seem like a trendy ingredient right now. It's almost like, you know, bacon tequila or something. And if I'm going to get high on caffeine, I'm going to have a third wave coffee or something. But again, it's not really that important. It's all the stuff around it and the preparation of it, and a bowl of matcha, or whisked right so the foam's right, it's a beautiful thing like anything else. I'm really more interested in everything around it, and also that if you ask people who are really into tea, they'll be the first to tell you that it's not about the tea, or it's not about the bike, I think was Lance Armstrong's book. It's about the process and the experience.
Well, you know, there, we kind of spoke about it when we walked through the exhibition. There are hidden gems everywhere. You know, there are things you're going to never notice if you walk through there 50 times, you know. Can I ask just sort of what you hope someone takes away from visiting this exhibition?
I hope that they would take a little time to look closely at anything. When you go to Japan, it's the most beautiful country on earth, because if you look at the ground or the sky or the garbage or inside a closet, everything is obsessed over. That's something that I've taken from my experience there, and whether it's the most humble bowl or a big sculpture, look closely at it, look at the surface, you know, touch it if no one's looking, because there's a tactile quality. There's four ways to stack a book: right side up, back side up, left, right. Everything matters. It's always a choice. And I'm very careful about how I put each piece together and all the screws. And we show all the screws and
glue drips and pencil marks. It's all left there. People always ask about refinement. And my rules of refinement in their studio are work the material all the way until you start to erase the evidence of the action. Then stop.
Well, Tom Sachs, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.